Okay, time once again for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy, special New York City edition, right, Stacy?
It's the second New York City edition. We'll be here for two more Saturdays as well. We're here this week. The Dow has hit an all-time high while we've been here. And Bitcoin also has. What does that tell you, Max Kaiser?
Oh, it's well, first of all, yeah, Dow hit a new all-time high, but it is also coming with all-time high in debt. So the Dow is a bubble, and Bitcoin is all basically cash on cash. And as people begin to lose faith in the central banks around the world, they're buying gold, they're buying silver, they're buying Bitcoin, which is now a $400 million industry. Bitcoin growing exponentially, and the price is in the mid-40s, got almost to 50 or just at 50, heading to a lot higher. According to Rick Folkving up in Sweden, you know, he thinks that if Bitcoin can capture 1% of the global Forex market, that would have an implied price of Bitcoin of $100,000 per Bitcoin, up from its current $46 level. If it captures 10% of the global market, it would imply a Bitcoin price of $1 million. So it's doing pretty much what we said. You know, people say Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme, but no, Bitcoin is an answer to the Ponzi scheme. Mm. The central banks are a Ponzi scheme. Wall Street is a Ponzi scheme. The UK banking cartels engage in massive fraud and are a massive Ponzi scheme. That's what Bitcoin came about as a reaction to that Ponzi scheme. Then people say, oh, well, Bitcoin's used in criminal activity. No, Bitcoin is in response to the criminal activity of Wall Street and the City of London and various banks around the world. So, you know, I use the analogy of the fishermen in Somalia. You know, they're just doing their little fishing. Then all their fish were stolen by Europeans, and they had to go into piracy. People focus on the piracy bit. They don't understand where it came from. It came from the fact that their livelihoods were destroyed. Now, the banking system has been destroyed by Ponzi schemes and fraud, and so Bitcoin in 2009 had to be invented to deal with that, and now it's becoming the most important world reserve currency.
Yeah, but you can't blame most people. They're even the right-on sort of people that listen to our show, watch our TV show, you know, are aware, watch and read other blogs, important blogs. They are so ingrained in this notion of speculation. They view everything as a speculative thing. And when somebody shouts Ponzi scheme about Bitcoin, most likely it's out of kind of envy or jealousy at a high point. And they're thinking, oh, if only I had bought it at $2 and now it's $45 and I would have made that money. So I've got to bash it because I feel angry. But, you know, what Rick Folkving is talking about when he says that Bitcoin, forget $500 or $100, it should be $100,000 to $1 million. That's where it's going to. He's talking about it as a transactional currency. This is based on the amount of transaction. If it captures 1% of the transactions globally that happen every day, then it should be that price. But a lot of people just, you know, they view everything, whether it's food prices or house prices or all the basic ingredients of you know, survival, they view everything as a speculative bubble and how to get rich quick without working.
Yeah, well, I think that's just basic ignorance out there. They say, oh, Bitcoin's a Ponzi scheme. I mean, that's just a knee-jerk reaction. They haven't really looked at it or thought about it. They just say, oh, it's new. So they just pull a word out of their butts and say, oh, it's a Ponzi scheme. They don't really, it's ignorant. It's an ignorant comment. They don't know what they're saying. Well, you know, it's just laziness. But more and more people obviously believe that in the Bitcoin story. That's why it's now a $400 million business and growing, and there's businesses that it's proliferating as it is because this people understand that it's a viable currency. And, of course, the question comes up, well, what collateralizes Bitcoin? There's nothing collateralizing it. And that's false also because what collateralizes Bitcoin is privacy. Privacy has become a scarce commodity in the world we live in. Think about it. Right now, you're being spied on. You're being spied on by your government that is collecting all of your emails, that has cameras, millions of cameras looking at you all day long. that is monitoring your social networking sites. So you are being spied on right now. So privacy, you know, even 20 years ago, was something that people could elect to be private. That election to be private has been taken away. So privacy has become probably the scarcest commodity in the world, and that's what collateralizes Bitcoin. It's a private transaction. It's cryptologically protected. It's outside the view of any government. That's what collateralizes Bitcoin. That's what makes it so valuable. So it's a scarcity value of privacy, just like gold and silver are driven by the scarcity value of gold and silver. Contrast that with the pound or the dollar. There's nothing scarce about them. They print trillions and trillions and trillions. They can do so all day long. There's nothing scarce about them. That's a Ponzi scheme.
And you know, it's important to point out about Bitcoin is it's private. It's not anonymous. It's not completely anonymous. There are, you know, it's like a tally stick online. It has to match with the other, and you can't be copied. It can't be counterfeited. But they could theoretically trace it to an ISP, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the other thing about it is it's limited in supply. There's only going to be, 21 million coins ever mined?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's 10 million that are now in existence. There's 25 new Bitcoins are created every 10 minutes, and that will continue until there's 21 million Bitcoins, and that's it.
Well, that's good on that. So actually, you could go to maxkaiser.com and look up that Max was interviewed by Abby Martin on Breaking the Set about Bitcoin. It was a really good interview. Mm. You from New York into D.C., Max Kaiser?
I was tying the current value appreciation of Bitcoin to a gauge of the genuine inflation that's going out there with all the money printing. It's not showing up in bond prices because bond prices are being manipulated by the banks that are printing all the money. It's not showing up in gold and silver as it should because gold and silver prices are being manipulated by the government. But it does show up in Bitcoin because governments can't manipulate Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is up 200% this year. This shows about the growth of money supply around the world is not far from that. So as the money supply increases exponentially, so will the value of Bitcoin because people are converting that trashy currency into something of intrinsic value like a Bitcoin.
I just got an email. We're recording this on Thursday, by the way, due to the time difference and travel plans. But I got an email from Ian Williams, one of our most viewed episodes of Kaiser Report, where he said silver will be going to $150 in the next 3 years. Well, he was saying that the UK equities will hit a new all-time high of 7,000, which is attainable based on all this money printing. But he also notes that bond yields, he said that they'll fall by, bonds will fall by 10%, UK gilts. And he said, FYI, Stacey, the long gilt is down 2% in the last hour since I penned this note. So my forecast of a 10% fall might be a bit tame.
Mm. Well, this is something we've talked about on Andrew Neil's Daily Politics show, that the bond market is ripe for a fall because it's been a Ponzi scheme, hasn't it, for the last 10 years. Certainly since the past 4 or 5 years since the 2008 collapse. The theory being that if governments can just buy all the bonds that they're creating, then they will they'll buy time, and that after 5 years, the animal spirits of Keynesianism will kick in and growth will organically appear. And jobs will start appearing, paying high wages, and then tax revenues from those high-paying jobs can be used to pay down the huge bond bubble. But that never happened. So now they can't fool the markets anymore, so bonds are going to collapse.
Now, we'll talk about silver, Ian Charteris has at Charteris Treasuries has to say about silver. This is very interesting. He said that silver miners, he said, have to rise between 300 and 400% without any move in the underlying price of the metal, because he's saying that right now gold and silver mining companies are at their cheapest relative to their metals for at least the last 30 years. In addition to this, he said silver will have to rise 300% relative to gold to restore their 16-to-1 ratio. This means that silver mining shares would have to rise at least 700% just to mean revert. So, you know, we had huge sell-offs in gold and silver miners, which quickly turned around to 10% gains the following day this week. But he's suggesting that they've got a sevenfold increase coming.
All right. So Endeavor Silver, which we know very well, traded at $5 yesterday. That means, according to Ian, it should be trading at $35 pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, that's what he's saying here. And so that's the other big thing. Everybody's been the other story, of course, on top of the precious metals, Bitcoin, dollars, is the call for housing markets. The housing markets are going crazy. I saw a Business Insider was just reporting that Credit Suisse is saying they've never seen the U.S. housing market like this, that there is like mass panic. People are piling in, trying to buy anything they could find. Yeah. So again, you know, looking back to the first Great Depression or the last Great Depression we had in the 1929 to 1937 is that this sort of greed has to be totally pounded out. People need to be so exhausted and hate everything for decades before you could have a genuine turnaround. So just like the freak bounces that you saw back in the Great Depression, could this be one of those sort of just suckers being sucked in again?
Well, up until the last 2 years, 95% of that house buying has been by hedge funds. And they're completely hedged against the reversal. Now you've got the public piling in at a time when interest rates are at 240-year lows and bond prices in America are at 240-year highs, meaning that bond prices would revert to the mean. Interest rates go from 0.5% to 5%, and anyone buying a house today with an adjustable rate mortgage would be negative equity by 50% in 24 months.
Yeah, that's what one of the reasons why they cite is that people want to get a house before interest rates rise. Of course, it makes sense the opposite. When interest rates are in a long downward trend, that the house prices would continue to rise. So people piling in now are pretty crazy.
Interest rates, sure, you lock in a mortgage and let's say you get a fixed rate mortgage, 30%, you buy a house. And the house is up 40% over the 2 years or 3 years. Well, value of the dollar is going to drop by 100, you know, 60, 70%. So the inflation, the collapse in the dollar, is it going to, your house will maintain some value in that kind of inflationary environment. But I think it's not a really, I don't think it's the best way to play it. I think if you had a choice, you would be buying gold and silver. Not houses, but I mean, a house at this point is not the worst thing to buy, but it's not the best thing to buy.
Yeah, of course, because a big problem with houses, of course, is when the governments are going broke and everything mm-hmm. is falling apart, they go after homeowners. We saw that in France, by the way, with François Hollande, is, you know, the taxes on corporations that he tried to apply and the taxes on the rich, of course, those were quickly reversed. He never actually implemented those, but the house prices, he went after all those foreign buyers of properties and stuff.
Property taxes. As the governments go bust, you know, Detroit is now being taken over by the state of Michigan, and that's a trend across the country. So property taxes go up. And you see that in the UK. People are complaining that their property taxes are increasing pretty sharply. And so they can't pay the property tax. So let's say you buy a house. It's up 40%, but you have, and the mortgage is low, but you lost your job, so you can't pay the mortgage, or you can just pay the mortgage. And inflation's high, so gas prices are high, food prices are high. Your equity's up, but now here comes a 200% rise in property tax. Can't pay it, so you lose your house anyway.
Yeah, because especially the way the states operate is that, you know, the pensions of the state workers are guaranteed, meaning that if the economy collapses and therefore income tax revenues decline, the state has to find another source of it. And they can't print it. They're in a situation like Greece or Italy or Spain. They can't print it. Only the federal government can. So they go after whatever they can get. And that's, of course, property. So that's one of the dangers of owning property, I think.
Yeah, it's not the worst investment, but I don't think it's anywhere near as good as gold or silver, or the mining stocks that you were just talking about are trading at 30-year lows against the price of the metals. So as a low risk, high reward trade, the precious metal miners are probably never, ever, ever, never, ever been as cheap as they are right now.
Well, that's what Ian Williams of Charters Treasury says. And by the way, speaking of properties, one of the boom markets, of course, is Florida. But only this week have we actually been told that there's such a thing as sinkhole season in Florida. This is a season when the most sinkholes appear. And as we saw this past week in Florida, a man was sucked into the earth, never to be found again. The police are saying he'll never, probably never be found again. So that seems like you couldn't pay me to be sucked into a sinkhole. So why would I want to buy a property down there?
Well, yeah, so the risk of housing, you've got the global warming, climate change catastrophes that are turning what previously thought to be really good spots. Suddenly they're in the path of climate chaos. So they're flooded, or there's hurricanes, or there's sinkholes. So that's another risk. And of course, the insurance companies don't allow you to buy flood insurance anymore on these properties. So if a flood comes and swallows up your home, that's it. Equity is gone.
Yeah, well, the flood insurance is bought through the government here. It's federal. And you can only buy flood insurance from the federal government in the US. So that's kind of like our healthcare system here. The federal government is going to be eventually in the business of, they're already in the business of old age, right? Because no, you can't get health insurance once you're over 65. So the government takes that on. Pretty soon it's going to be for cancer, heart problems, obesity, or diabetes, any of the problems that are long term and cost money to the health insurance. And pretty soon you'll only have health insurance available for, really simple problems like cataracts. That's the big thing that the private sector does in the UK.
Right, nickel and diming people to death and forcing people to buy insurance, and then of course they don't pay out the claims when it's time to pay the claim. So this is just a shakedown. So in Mexico you might have a cop shaking you down on the highway for $50. In America, the government forces you to buy insurance that they'll never allow you to get claimed on.
Yeah, I mean, because in France, of course, the healthcare system there is that it's, there are a bunch of different health insurance companies, and there are some run by unions or the, it's hard to describe what they are, the collectives in a way of certain sectors. So if you work in the media industry, there's a certain media group that pays out your claims for your health insurance, but they never deny you. They never, like in America, if you go to the doctor and they say, oh, you need open heart surgery, you've got to call your health insurance company first and get approval. Lord knows why Americans think what happens in Europe is a death panel compared to that. But to call some, person making $8 an hour as a receptionist at Aetna and have to say, can I have open heart surgery? The doctor says I need it. Well, I have to look at your plan, see what we can approve for you.
Yeah, if you look at the healthcare system in the US, the UK, and France, in the UK, it doesn't make sense to me because they don't charge anything. You go in there, it's completely without charge to go in and see into the emergency room or whatever, see a doctor. And that's stupid because they should charge you 20 or £30 minimum. And that would collect a good chunk of money. And you would avoid people who are just crybabies who go in there because they have a hangnail and they take up time and energy. So for £20, it discourages that kind of silly behavior. In the US, it's absurd because it's the highest cost of anywhere in the world. It doesn't work. It doesn't deliver. It's a joke. So then there's France, which is kind of an interesting hybrid in that you see the doctor and it costs like 20 or 30 euros to see the doctor. And then you give them your health card and the rest is paid for per the insurance that you bought. And the costs are one of the lowest in the world, and the service is some of the highest in the world. So you end up with what many consider to be the best healthcare system in the world. Having lived in France for 14 years, I can tell you that I think it's pretty good.
Actually, a friend of mine was making a huge budget film there, and he's American, and he didn't have any he didn't have insurance, bizarrely, for such a big studio film. He didn't have insurance for coverage in Europe. And he had a tooth problem, like he had to have a tooth pulled. And he went to the dentist and he was like, "Oh, you're not on the system here? Well, you'll have to pay." And this friend of mine was getting ready to have like money transferred. He was contacting his family in America that they were going to have to transfer this money, thinking like $1,000, like it would cost here to have your tooth pulled with anesthetic. And it was like 60 euros. He said it was 60 euros. And he was just so shocked that even the doctor, though, the dentist was like, "Ooh, but you don't have insurance? Wow. It's going to be 60 euros. Like, it was really expensive.
Yeah, I've had that experience, too. The doctor says, "You don't have insurance." "Oh, oh wow, I'm going to have to charge you." And then they hand you a bill for 20 euros. And they had a look on their face like, "I'm so sorry. I'm sorry, but that's just the way I have to do this." And you're laughing, of course, like, "Wow, 20 euros. Well, incredible." So that's the story. They have figured it out. You know, they do some things good and some things not so good. But the healthcare in France, they figured it out. It's the best in the world at the cheapest. And UK is screwed up, and now there's huge pressure to privatize the healthcare. So that's going to go the way of the U.S. It should go the way of France if they were smart, but unfortunately they're not. So they're going to go the way of the U.S. and totally destroy it.
Yeah, you know, the one of the medical bodies, I guess, representing the 220,000 doctors in the UK, they've come out strongly against this in the last week. There's this letter sent to the health secretary, and all the doctors in the UK are really against this privatization because, of course, one of the problems here in the US is it's not the doctors who make huge salaries here. Some of them do, like some plastic surgeons and top dermatologists and stuff like that. But the doctors have a lot of paperwork to fill out. I mean, just even with, so my mom has been sick, and every time she has to get a procedure, the doctors, always the insurance company, every single time rejects every single first claim, every time. And therefore, the doctor has to write a letter. This is how they make money. This is how the insurance companies make their money, is they just reject the claim. And in order to have it overturned, the doctor has to write a personal letter explaining why it was, in fact, necessary, and then try to get it overturned. Now, most of the time, they're just too busy to do that. But they spend a lot of their time, a lot of their daily activity, just sending letters to this vast bureaucracy at these health insurance companies, which is where all the money is made. Those guys are making $30 million a year as the CEO of an insurance company, and the top execs are making millions.
Yeah, so, you know, medical apartheid. So if you have, if you can afford to fill out all the paperwork, you get health care. If you don't, then you live in the ghetto, you know, the health ghetto. And your life expectancy in America for these people is dropping pretty quickly. It's one of the worst in the developed world now. It's approaching really the emerging world. And similar to banking, if you have buddies on Wall Street, the cost of borrowing money is zero or less than zero. If not, you're in the ghetto paying payday loan rates, 2,000% a year annualized. So it's apartheid health, apartheid banking. It's an apartheid system. It's a neo-feudal system. It's a new model that is making the top 400 families quite wealthy and putting everyone else into the ghetto.
Yeah, well, speaking of ghettos, we're outside the ghettos because most areas are ghettos. But we've been in London, Paris, and New York. I think I said it last week. You know, and it is quite remarkable how this Great Depression, unlike the first Great Depression, you know, during the first Great Depression, my grandparents lived here in New York City. And my grandfather, who was an accountant, he was out in the street selling apples. He was one of those guys selling apples here in New York City. Now, that you haven't seen. Like, you don't see that here because, of course, during the first Great Depression, we had the gold standard, and they weren't just handing out free gold, were they? But now they're handing out free money to these too-big-to-fail money centers. And we've also seen yesterday, before the Senate, Eric Holder admitted that, yes, there are a few banks that are too big to jail. We won't prosecute them because it'll destabilize the global financial system, he said.
That's right. You don't see people selling Apple on the streets, but I think a lot of people just scrape by selling junk on eBay. You know, they go to junk sales and they buy stuff and they sell it on eBay and they make a few bucks here and there. So the underground electronic economy, I think, supports a lot of people who are just kind of scratching, getting by. And yeah, this Eric Holder story is pretty interesting. It echoes what they said. The Lanny Brower story, he made a similar comment. Also in the UK, they made a similar comment. So the justice departments around the world agree that the too big to fail banks are too big to jail. We can't prosecute because they threaten to harm us. So I don't understand the policy. Here in the U.S., they have a drone policy where they send drones out to target bad people. But they let the people in the country who are committing the massive destabilizing banking fraud that's causing hundreds of millions of people thrust into poverty and millions of deaths, they seem to think that's okay. So they're on drugs, they're on bath salts. It's hard to explain.
Well, the point is, it's not in Eric Holder or the Department of Justice mandate to provide economic stability or financial market stability. That's not their mandate. Their mandate is to apply the rule of law. And so what's he doing involving himself in financial policy? That's not his job. He should prosecute those who have committed crimes. And taking out Lloyd Blankfein for packaging up, for, you know, heading a team of fraudsters who sold fraudulent mortgage-backed securities shouldn't take down Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs should have a new head who isn't a crook, you know, if that's the case, if they're going to be taken out and sent to jail for 20 years.
Yeah, everyone wants to be an economist because the economists are the new rock stars. So Eric Holder wants to hang out with the cool kids. So he's saying, we can't prosecute because it'll hurt the economy. And then he'll whip out some algorithm that he learned at some on a box, some cereal box that he was chomping down in the morning, and he gets to hang out with the cool kids. But he's supposed to be
impartial.
The law, you know, he's supposed to be a part of the Justice Department. But that's not cool anymore. It's not cool to be a cop or a Justice Department anymore. So he's like, I don't want to be that. So he should just resign, you know, and go join Goldman Sachs. Why has he even got this job? I mean, I understand that he gets to make a lot of public speeches, and he probably has a pretty high clothes budget, and he's a clothes horse, and he likes to flash his pecs or whatever. I mean, he's probably just some closet, you know, guy.
Well, however, in America, there's over 2 million men in prison being raped right now as we speak. And yet they're too big to fail for their own, you know, private economy. So multiply that, the network effect of how many sole providers or, you know, household incomes are devastated by the fact that the men are in prison for, you know, half the prisoners in the federal prison system are for drugs. So it's just having, you know, a small amount of marijuana sometimes.
Right. And the case that he wasn't prosecuting was HSBC,
yeah,
which was caught laundering $400 billion for Mexican drug cartel. So he's putting drug guys who are the customers of the drug cartel in jail, but he's not putting the cartel in jail because he says it would be destabilizing to the economy, of which he has no purview. That's not his bailiwick. That's not his job. So he's wrong on many, many, many counts. He's like a walking, talking clown where he just makes no sense. You can get more sense, you know, out of, you know, it's just absurd.
Well, just to clarify, it was HSBC laundered $7 billion in Mexican drug cartel money, and it was Wachovia that laundered $400 billion, $387 billion to be exact. But bizarrely, that didn't get much attention at all. Like, that was the first of these huge, obvious crimes. To launder $387 billion certainly doesn't happen accidentally. It goes far up the chain, and yet nobody really ever looked at that, because I guess that information came out as the global financial system was collapsing and Lehman Brothers was collapsing. That came out at a, you know, that was literally dumping the news.
Yeah, but we heard that the reason the system collapsed is because they were investigating and the drug cartel said, we're going to stop laundering the money through your system. And so they were going to turn off the spigot and that caused the crash. So it's all connected.
Well, that's a hypothesis that we came up with, and I think it's a good one. And I think what happened was that it was not really that way. It was a little bit the opposite. The Gonzalez's, you know, the previous attorney general warned Wachovia that they were going to be investigated for this, the Mexican drug cartel money laundering. And because of that, they shut down those Casa de Cambios that were in London, that were a conduit for this laundered money out of Mexico via London back into the U.S. And so they shut those down. And literally 2 weeks later, the financial crash happened. The liquidity crisis hit. And then a year later, almost a year later, the financial system, once Lehman Brothers and all the other banks were on the brink of collapse, the U.N. Special Rapporteur on drug money laundering, he said that that money laundering cash was the only thing keeping the system afloat.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't see the difference between these two events in terms of what the Justice Department should be looking at. They have banks that are laundering massive amounts of money that he's saying he can't prosecute because if he did, it would destroy the economy.
Yeah. Well, obviously because they provide all the illicit money for the liquidity in the system.
That's right. But I don't see how that's outside of his job as a justice guy. I thought he's supposed to be, is he just a drug dealer?
So what else has been happening? What else have you been observing in New York City? Any observations to make? By the way, we thought we were going to get one of these true Snowmageddon sort of things. You know, everything has to be Snowmageddon or Snowpocalypse, or this week it was called Snowquester. There was supposed to be a giant snowstorm that hit New York and shut down Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. just shut down preemptively. They shut down all federal buildings. Employees didn't have to show up. They shut down schools. And apparently it was just rain that showed up. And the same thing here. But I was looking forward to one of these freak storm events that are increasingly happening. I thought we would see some real trauma. By the way, our hotel that we're staying in is a FEMA cap.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. The big floods that came in, Hurricane Superstorm Sandy, which there was a blackout in New York City from 38th or something street down to the Battery Park. And this hotel is around 38th Street or so. So refugees from downtown ended up staying here under the direction of FEMA.
Yeah, it was from 39th Street down. It was all blacked out. We're in the, you know, in the 30s. And this is one of the hotels that they said, first of all, it was shut down. It was evacuated for a week because there was no electricity. And then afterward, it reopened as part of, it was housing refugees, basically, from downtown New York. But there are still people here to this day. And I said, you're kidding me, because is FEMA still paying? And he said, yes. And they pay way above rack rate. So they pay more than any tourist would pay. And so those people are still living in this hotel. I'm surprised about that. I thought, you know, the U.S. federal government was more stingy than that. I thought it was like maybe 2 weeks of emergency housing they would give you, maybe 4 weeks at most, and that you would have to then sort yourself out. But they're still housing people in expensive hotels in Manhattan.
Well, it's not that the federal government is stingy. It's that they're poorly run, yeah, and they waste money. And so now they don't have any more money to waste. That's the problem. So, yeah, here's another example. The federal government is paying people to live here in this hotel well past the crisis point. But they just don't. The bureaucracy is such that I'm sure it's just lost somewhere, and they just don't have any idea what's going on. And they're paying this incredible taxpayer money. I might as well, instead of paying taxes, I might as well just give it to these people down on the fourth floor.
Yeah, but like maybe they're just forgotten. Those they're like those Japanese soldiers out in those islands that are still think it's World War II, or this week, did you see they found this Soviet soldier, a former Soviet soldier in Afghanistan? Mm-mm. He went missing in 1980, and they thought he was lost in action. Remember, the Soviet Union used to occupy Afghanistan before the American Empire now occupies Afghanistan. But they found this guy who was presumed dead, and they found him, 30 years later? He's living in a cave with these guys. He's all happy there. He has his own little tribe, I guess.
Oh, wow, that's cool. What? It's a wild country, Afghanistan. It's going to be, so he's got the cave thing going.
Yeah, remember, who's our friend, that German guy who wrote for Der Spiegel? I forget his name. We interviewed him on the Oracle. But he was saying when he was in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, flying over Afghanistan, you just realize this is just an insane country to try to occupy, and why it's where empires go to die. Why empires die there? Because it's just mountain after mountain after mountain after little villages in every single crevice of every single mountain run by a local tribal leader. So like when you went into Iraq, you just paid off like a few warlords or tribal leaders, like, you know, 100. There in Afghanistan, there's just thousands and thousands of them to try to get any sort of loyalty to the occupying army. So apparently there was one run by some Soviet dude who lived peacefully for 30 something years until, lo and behold, he's been somehow found out by the social media world.
Oh my God. Yeah, he shouldn't, if you're running and living in a cave, he shouldn't open a Facebook page, I guess. That's the lesson there.
So we also interviewed this week Pierre Jovanovic. Oh, by the way, this is The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM. We've got about 20 minutes left here on this episode of The Truth About Markets. And we're going to talk about Pierre Jovanovic from France. He's a Parisian. He's a talk show, radio talk show there in Paris, one of the most popular in France. And it was really interesting because we interviewed him about the French economy. And, you know, there were some American trolls, I guess you could call them, who came onto the YouTube. First of all, they said, this guy is obviously fake. He has a fake French accent, which is pretty crazy. But then the other, how, once again, this notion of how extreme right so much stuff is going. Here's Pierre, who I would put on the right of French politics,
yeah,
center right, and he was being called a communist,
right,
by people on YouTube, presumably Americans, and it's just like it's just disintegration of any sort of meaning that we see going on all around us. Everybody is a Nazi. Everybody is a terrorist. Everybody is a communist, everybody's a socialist. Like, words no longer have any meaning because the wall is a communist just as much as your shoes are communist and you are communist and Warren Buffett is communist and David Koch is communist. Everybody's a communist.
Well, it's just propaganda. So Bitcoin's a Ponzi scheme. So that's, yeah, that's as deep as anyone, most people think about it. Meanwhile, it's going to make a move from 50 to 500 to 5,000 to 500,000, and it's going to be the story of the decade. But people won't be, you know, shaken from their propaganda. And the French people are communists. Now, that's just propaganda. Within France, there are right-wing people and there are left-wing people. I guess in the Netherlands, they broke through because they had a very hard right neo-Nazi party come to power. And this guy, Pim, whatever his name is, the filmmaker, was murdered. And I think people kind of figured out, wow, you know, maybe Europe is not all communist. You know, they see something. Although they'll see neo-Nazis in Germany, and they're like, well, maybe Germany is not just all communist. So aside from the couple of things kind of breaking through the echo chamber, most people in America anyway, their perception of Europe and of France is that it's quote-unquote communist. So but they've never looked at it or talked about it or studied it or had any idea about it. You know, most people in America get 95% of their education about the world from South Park. So if South Park might have a joke that says, oh, France, communist, then that's what America believes.
You know, there was another bastardization of words this week, mostly from the U.S. press. I didn't see this sort of distortion of language happening out of the U.K., but that was when Hugo Chavez died, and all these Americans, bozos, you know, jerks on Twitter calling him a dictator, which, you know, in democracy, Thomas Jefferson did suggest that basically democracy rather than a republic is a form of tyranny, a form of dictatorship where the majority dictates over the minority. So surely there was an elite, mostly white guys in Venezuela, who could theoretically call the majority tyrants and dictators for, you know, forming policy around their needs. But he was one of the most elected leaders on earth. Mm-hmm. He won by popular vote. So you can't call him a dictator. People were calling him fascist. The guys who brought in the CIA and engineered a coup are still alive and walking around. It's not like they were killed. America would have droned them. I mean, my God, that American citizen in Yemen, Al-Awlaki, he just said death to America or whatever on a video podcast, and he gets droned to death. Mm. And yet, you know, these bozos who are just so absorbed in, like, just major distortion and not understanding the words they say.
Well, there is no left-wing press in America. There's the hard right, and then there's the middle right, but there's not even any center. I mean, maybe Amy Goodman, I'd say she's in the center. You know, she's a good journalist. She's in the center. But she's not a mainstream media. So in mainstream media, there's only far right and middle right. I mean, I would say Rachel Maddow is on the right. Jon Stewart is definitely on the right. He pushes that Pentagon story hard, and now he's taking 4 months off to make a movie about attacking Iran. So Jon Stewart has gone, you know, jumped the shark. He's making this film. He's taking some time off. And it's a film that's vilifying Iran and setting the stage for the invasion of Iran. So he's always been a very right-wing commentator. Stephen Colbert is a fake right-wing commentator that ends up being a right-wing commentator. Rachel Maddow, I mean, the most, I mean, it's not, you know, I don't want this to sound wrong, but it's not an accident that the person who is the least right wing is, you know, this lesbian chick who is easily dismissed by the right wing as being a lesbian chick. So there's no Rush Limbaugh of the left. There's no Bill O'Reilly of the left. There's no Michael Savage of the left in America, because they simply can't take that kind of debate in America. If you had actual debate in America, it would suddenly, you know, their heads would explode, and sales of drugs and alcohol would plummet, and you know, the whole country would disappear in a heartbeat. So it's just not going to happen.
And then the other bastardization of language and principles that you see is, you know, this 13-hour filibuster by Rand Paul of the John Brennan nomination. John Brennan, you know, who was involved with this whole, as The Guardian exposed this week very clearly, that Rumsfeld brought in the same dirty war torturers that operated in Latin America in the 80s. He brought them to Iraq and formed those hit squads. Remember all those death squads in Latin America? Well, he brought those death squads to Iraq. And remember, at the time, we talked about it here on The Truth About Markets, those, when you would find 20 guys shot dead. That was classic Latin America. And that happened right after Negroponte went to join the team involved. And remember, he was also involved with Latin America. So anyway, The Guardian has an excellent expose this week pointing out that these death squads were brought there. Again, all these Americans shrieking on Twitter this week about dictator Chavez and dictator that and communists in Europe. And yet these death squads were being orchestrated, engineered, and deployed by the U.S. Pentagon. Zero. Crickets. Literally crickets online. Nobody said anything about it. But here's Rand Paul filibustering John Brennan's nomination because Eric Holder sent a letter in response to Rand Paul's question about drone policy in the U.S., i.e. not just surveillance drones, but actually weaponized drones, which could target and assassinate. Well, Eric Holder said it's unlikely that they would ever target an American on American soil, mm-hmm. but they can't rule it out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, all the so-called progressives and liberals are mocking anybody for supporting Rand Paul's filibuster because, well, Rand Paul is all for getting rid of the Civil Rights Act, or, you know, they point to something else. It's not about the principle. They don't seem to care themselves that this confession has come out that they could see a situation where they might target Americans on American soil with drones.
Yeah, that's right. So, well, yeah, Rand Paul's doing the filibuster. And I've said on occasion that I think Rand Paul's a complete no good guy. But now he's doing something that I have to say looks pretty positive. So the opinion on Rand Paul is vacillating wildly between bad guy, good guy, bad guy, good guy. And that's the way it is sometimes. So this particular instance, it seems like he's following a principled stand here.
Yeah, you reward good behavior, you punish bad behavior, and therefore you get what you want. So if you reward him for saying something good and punish him when he says something stupid, then he eventually just does the good stuff, right?
I think so, yeah. Well, I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? It's like, wow, I can get votes by doing this principled stuff. I guess I'll do more of it.
But I just kind of call it hee-hawing. People like, hee-haw, hee-haw, hee-haw. That's what they're like on Twitter. It's like everything is snarky and like, like it's a South Park Beavis and Butthead sort of thing. Everything is like, everything is condescending. Everything is like, everybody thinks they're so superior in their certainty and their whole political outlook. And it's just, it's like, draining. You go there and you just like are drained of any will to live.
Well, it's vapid, and it comes from the collapse of any kind of cultural integrity. So you don't have anything culturally happening anymore. So there's nothing aesthetic that's interesting. It's just collapse on. It's a sinkhole. So this is the way people behave when culture experiences a sinkhole of aesthetics. So there's no, you know, plastic surgery totally killed the whole idea of the female figure, didn't it? I mean, the female figure was interpreted over the centuries by different artists in different ways, and there was no defined aesthetic of beauty as defined by the lowest common denominator, which then fed into the plastic surgery industry, which then set into an arms race of boob enhancement, and that aesthetic equals big boobs. So that goes against millions of years of culture. But that's applied across the cultural spectrum. So the cultural aesthetics are being dictated by lowest common denominator, whether it's the female form, whether it's the written form, whether it's any artistic expression. It all comes basically back down to what you call the hee-hawing, the donkey version. There is no... The ascent of man has now in reverse. We're now in the descent of man. We're going backwards. We're going backwards rapidly. We're going into the sinkhole. And there's a few branches along the way to try to cling on to delay the inevitable crash to the bottom of the abyss. But unfortunately, that's all there is.
Speaking of that, I read a frightening piece last night before I went to bed from an interview with this guy from Oxford University. There's some sort of futures center. They look at the future. And they're talking about the Mars rover, you know, the rover there on Mars, which actually they said kind of like a Terminator. It's a very advanced robotics. But there's a deep question about, you know, the Earth is relatively young compared to some other planets in our galaxy. Mm-hmm. And they're finding more and more planets with possibly, you know, that are habitable.
Mm-hmm.
And they reckon that if it's happened here in our corner of the universe, then the forming of, you know, single cells into multiple cells into, you know, that advanced life is going to be common. Mm-hmm. But the question is, like, the scary thing about this Mars rover, they said, is why aren't they here? Why haven't they made contact if these civilizations are older? And right. that's really, that's, if
I think it's obvious, the answer. I mean, if you have a younger brother or sister, you know, you try to ditch them, don't you? Because they're annoying. So the advanced civilizations, they don't want to contact Earth because we're annoying. We're too snarky. They're like, ugh, not those Earthlings again. They're just queens.
Well, the point is, he's saying that for advanced creatures, you would want to get off planet no matter what, because there is certain extinction in that the sun will explode within 4 billion years. So there's guaranteed extinction. But there are other planets that are already closer to their sun disintegrating, their star disintegrating. So why haven't they been able to leave their solar systems and galaxies to get to the newer, younger galaxies? Because that's what we'll have to do eventually if humans survive 4 billion years.
Yeah, but isn't that a remarkably narcissistic view of things? Why, if these are advanced intelligence, why would they bother with this? And look what we're doing here. We're exhibiting symptoms of extreme narcissism and delusions of grandeur and psychopathology. Why would any advanced civilization want to be anywhere near this point?
Well, he's not even saying that. They don't need to contact us, but we need to find evidence that they have been able to leave their planet, whether it's on Mars, whether it's on other planets we're able to eventually see. Is there any sign that they've been able to leave their own planets and move somewhere else? So we need to be able to leave our solar system and eventually our galaxy if we're going to have eternal life, if we're going to forever live as a species.
Yeah, over 4 billion years. You know, the technology is advancing so rapidly due to the evolution of technology becoming ever faster that clearly we'll be in touch not only with other intelligent life forms in this universe, but we'll be in touch with intelligent life forms in parallel universes. And then that'll be a game changer, I think.
Well, but that's what I'm saying, is he's saying there are other planets that are billions of years older than us and therefore should have had more advanced or as advanced as us.
But so how do we know they're not traveling now, but they're just traveling in a way that we can't detect? You know, if they can hitch a ride on a proton, you know, the proton is speeding through the galaxy and when it goes right in front of our face and we're like, where's everybody? I don't see nothing. You know, it's right there, but can't see it because we're technologically stupid.
He did posit that as a possible reason why we can't see it.
Well, you know, is there life on Uranus? That's always been my burning question.
Well, anyway, I will try to find a link to that where I actually, it's here. It's right here. Are humans headed for...
Yeah, I told you. It's right in front of your face.
Are humans headed for extermination by robots? You can Google that. Once we build an artificial intelligence smarter than us, will it decide that we're no longer necessary?
Well, that's why I already told you that this is my theory of God, is that we will give birth to our doppelgangers. You know, we the robots are created in our image. But in so doing, we've poisoned the Earth so badly that we'll become extinct. But the robots that are created in our image will live, and then they will have an existential crisis wondering, where did we come from? Because all evidence of us will have been exterminated and poisoned out of existence. And if you go back to how we came about, it was probably the same thing. God died in childbirth. God giving birth to us in this existence did so at the expense of his environment or her environment. And as we have an existential crisis. We say, where is God? Well, God died giving birth to us, just as we are dying giving birth to the next generation that is in our image. So this is a repeat. We've seen this before. It's repeating forever.
Well, the guy's name is Nick Bostrom. He heads Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute, and he thinks about existential risk for a living, what might happen and how we might cope. His biggest worries, in fact, aren't asteroids or volcanoes or even nuclear weapons or biological killers. It's artificial intelligence, the technology that's a few imaginative leaps from what we have now. The problem, in short, is that we humans aren't very bright. Our brains are good at some functions, but inept at others. Some future creation, a sort of super, 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 super computer as yet undreamt of, could eventually outwit us. And it's really fascinating because he talks about how you know, even if we try to, we've made this creation that starts to destroy the earth in order to perpetuate itself.
Yeah.
Because we're like, to him, to this supercomputer, it has no emotion or feeling. So just as we dig up the ground and build, make a building or a house without any care for the ant colonies living there.
Yeah.
That we could be like ant colonies to the supercomputer. And even if we try to stop it and lock it inside, you like Yucca Mountain with all the nuclear waste and try to lock it in there and, you know, control it, that there could be a point where we don't have any control over it, that yeah, it can.
Well, my biggest fear is immortality. My biggest fear is that I'll be alive forever and be tortured by robots for the rest of eternity. That's my biggest fear, that the option to die and to rest in peace, to be gone forever from this plane of existence, will be taken away. The biggest, the greatest, the most sacred right of all, the right to disappear from this plane of existence, will be taken from us as our DNA is kept animated for eternity by robots who just torture us.
He said that he hopes that the Curiosity rover won't find evidence of previous civilization on Mars. He said that would be a bad omen about our future. He said, quote, it would give us reason to suspect that nature is very good at knitting atoms into complex animal life, but very bad at nurturing star-hopping civilizations. It would make it less likely that humans have already slipped through the trap, whose jaws keep our skies lifeless.
Well, that's great. I'm happy for him.
So anyway, that's it for this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM in London. Remember, you can always continue to donate every month to Resonance 104.4 FM. Go to resonancefm.com, donate to them. The lunch with Max and Stacey you can find at maxkaiser.com on the right-hand column. It's at $505. You can bid for that. That will happen. We'll close that in April 1st. And that's it for this episode.
Bye, y'all.